From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. As Israel intensifies its military occupation of the Palestinian territories in the wake of the attacks on the U.S., an exclusive interview with Professor Edward Said. And the UN warns of a humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan. Up to 1 million Afghans could face starvation as Bush officials prepare to bomb them. We'll go to Islamabad and Peshawar. All that and more coming up on the War and Peace Report. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the World Trade Center towers once stood. A group of Norwegian academics say that President George Bush should be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize if he manages to catch those responsible for the attacks on the U.S. without sparking a war and causing further loss of innocent lives. The 12 university professors and other intellectuals nominated Bush in a Norwegian daily. They said their pacifist proposal was aimed to make the world think about ways of solving conflict without escalation of violence. President Bush launched a financial offensive against Osama bin Laden yesterday, freezing the assets of the Saudi Exiles Organization and its sympathizers while threatening foreign banks with the same treatment if they fail to cooperate with the U.S. initiative. The order froze the assets of 27 individuals and organizations suspected of links with bin Laden's al-Qaeda and other networks. It went further than a similar order issued by the Clinton administration, expanding the category of targeted groups to include all those, quote, associated with designated terrorist groups. The order also gave the Treasury Department the authority to freeze the U.S. assets and transactions of foreign banks which did not cooperate with the U.S. President Bush made it clear that European banks could be targeted and said he recognized the countries concerned might have to rewrite their laws to meet U.S. demands. President Bush yesterday backed off the administration's pledge to quickly release evidence against Osama bin Laden. He said doing so could, quote, make the war more difficult to win. Secretary of State General Colin Powell, standing at Bush's side, sent an entirely different signal a day earlier when he said the administration in the near future would be able to release a document that will describe clearly the evidence. The ruling Taliban in Afghanistan has said it would hand over Osama bin Laden if the U.S. presented credible evidence of his guilt. Other countries have also urged the U.S. to use legal mechanisms in its quest for justice rather than military force. Saudi Arabia cut all ties with Afghanistan's Taliban government today, saying Afghan leaders were defaming Islam by harboring and supporting terrorists. The move by one of the most influential nations in the Islamic world marks a major step forward for the United States in its effort to put pressure on and isolate the Taliban. Under intense U.S. lobbying, the United Arab Emirates shut the Afghan embassy in Dubai and severed ties with the Taliban on Saturday, leaving Pakistan the only country to maintain diplomatic relations with the Taliban. Bin Laden's al-Qaeda organization, meanwhile, issued a fiery new statement today warning Washington against attacks against either or Afghanistan. The statement read, "Wherever there are Americans and Jews, they will be targeted. We can defend ourselves. The holy warriors are fully prepared." The World Health Organization warned yesterday that new advances in technology have made it possible for terrorists to kill millions of people with chemical or biological weapons. The draft 179-page report was rushed out after calls for advice on how to combat germ warfare. World Health Organization released the report as it emerged that an order would be issued in the U.S. today grounding all crop dusting planes amid fears that those behind the September 11th attacks may have been plotting to use the aircraft to spray chemical or biological weapons. The nation's largest commercial pilots union said yesterday it'll seek support from Congress to arm pilots as a last line of defense against hijackers. The extraordinary proposal came as lawmakers in the Bush administration accelerate efforts to draft plans for expanding airport and airline security in the wake of the September 11th hijackings. A union spokesperson said this is a radical change for airline pilots, but it's an indication of the threat. He said the union envisioned a voluntary program run by federal law enforcement. Again, Maine U.S. Pilots Union wants members, the pilots, to carry guns. The House yesterday unanimously approved legislation that would provide $582 million to pay back dues to the United Nations, a reflection of how the political landscape has been altered by the attacks 2 weeks ago. For months, conservatives have blocked the payment of the UN arrears. During a brief floor debate yesterday afternoon, followed by a voice vote, both Republicans and Democrats said the United States cannot afford to ignore the UN's needs at a time when Bush administration officials are seeking a broad international coalition to support U.S. military strikes against Afghanistan. White House officials have lobbied behind the scenes for the money since the attacks. And the Bush administration's urgent quest for new anti-terrorism laws bogged down in Congress yesterday as lawmakers from both parties expressed concern that the hastily prepared package could greatly expand police powers at the expense of privacy and other civil liberties. At a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee, skeptical members confronted Attorney General John Ashcroft and other senior Justice Department officials on a number of administration proposals, including one that would permit the indefinite detention without trial of immigrants suspected of ties to terrorist groups. They also said the administration is trying to force the package through Congress without giving lawmakers time to adequately digest proposals that could have serious unforeseen consequences for rights that Americans now take for granted. Right-wing Congressmember Bob Barr, the conservative Georgia Republican, asked, "Why is it necessary to rush this through? Does it have anything to do with the fact that the department has sought many of these authorities on numerous other occasions, has been unsuccessful in obtaining them, and now seeks to take advantage of what is obviously an emergency situation to obtain authorities that it has been unable to obtain previously?" At the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, meanwhile, Ashcroft's proposed expansion of a provision of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which governs wiretapping of non-Americans inside the United States, ran into trouble not only with Democrats and civil liberties advocates, but also with at least one Republican member of Congress. Stop the War Now, Edwin Starr, here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the World Trade Center towers once stood. And today, the smell outside is particularly acrid as we continue to be inside the evacuation zone where hundreds of emergency workers continue to take away rubble, and yet no survivors have been found in many days. Since the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, political commentators have flooded the mainstream media with superficial commentary about the nature of Islam, its relation to the Taliban, and the challenges the U.S. faces in being understood and appreciated in the Muslim and Arab world. The Bush administration is continuing in its efforts to convince Arab and Muslim states to support its plans for wide-ranging military action against the Taliban, using a combination of threats, diplomacy, and the lure of military and economic aid. but there's still little reflection on the social, political, and economic basis of the resentment that U.S. power has engendered, not just in the Middle East and Central Asia, but around the world. There's been even less discussion of what a just relationship with Arab and Muslim states might look like, or how the U.S. might get there, ideas that seem lost in the Bush administration's single-minded preparation for a war we still know almost nothing about. We're joined on the telephone right now by Edward Said. He's a professor of comparative literature at Columbia University, an author of many books, including Orientalism, The Culture of Imperialism, and his memoir, Time Out of Place. He is also considered a leading voice for Palestinian self-determination. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Professor Said.
Thank you, Amy.
Thomas Friedman writes in his column in today's New York Times, quote, "I understand that this particular act of terrorism we just experienced is something so much more frightening than what Beirut's residents had to deal with." He ends his column with the reflection, "I went to the ball game Friday night, took in Dvorak's New World Symphony at the Kennedy Center Saturday, took my girls out to breakfast in Washington Sunday morning, then flew to the University of Michigan. Heck, I even went out yesterday and bought some stock. What a great country. I wonder what Osama bin Laden did in his cave in Afghanistan yesterday." Professor Said, can you comment, help us unpack some of the assumptions in these words?
Well, I think in the first place, speaking as a New Yorker and somebody who's lived here really the major part of his life, I mean, I'm second to none in feelings of horror and sorrow and disorientation as a result of what happened. But there's no need, I think, to take us out of history and out of time and turn the agony of New York into sort of a unique event of all time. I mean, I'm a man of two worlds, really. I mean, my entire family went through the siege of Beirut by the Israeli army, when in the course of 3 months, 20,000 people in a country of roughly 2.5 million people were killed by the Israeli army, basically people living with no protection, no anti-aircraft guns, no missiles, nothing to protect the onslaught of Israeli F-15s and helicopter gunships and missiles and rockets and all the rest of it. So, you know, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. I mean, we're suffering under such horror is equal, it seems to me, in every part of the world. And what is implicit in a lot of what Friedman writes is that the Arabs and Muslims are to be talked down to, that somehow their experiences are not as valid or somehow not as valuable as those of the so-called West. I mean, I say so-called because the West is really a very nebulous idea. Most Lebanese think of themselves perhaps as part of the West. So, you know, it's difficult to make to draw distinctions of this sort. The other is that the experiences, much as one hates them and despises them, the experiences that produce the kind of mad mindset of which Osama bin Laden has become the embodiment are the tip of the iceberg. I myself don't understand what would drive a person to suicide and to the kind of mass murder that these bombers did on September the 11th. But certainly the feeling of resentment and human dismissal, which a lot of people in the Arab and Islamic world feel, is very, very real. Not because of some fantasy about America. Most of them, in fact, are very interested in and fascinated and indeed like America. Their children coming. I'm talking now about the intellectuals, of whom, of course, Osama and his people are examples. They're not wretched of the earth. They're not people who live in a refugee camp. These are educated, middle-class people who have gone bananas as a result of the tremendous pressure on their minds of what they perceive as American contempt and dismissal of them as human beings, their religion, their culture. It's very difficult for a Muslim today in Pakistan or in Saudi Arabia or in Egypt not to make connections between the agonies of Chechnya, the agonies of the Palestinians, the contempt with which Islam is regularly discussed and treated in the media, the way in which the United States has, for the last 10 years, more or less single-handedly been inflicting a regime of horrendous genocidal sanctions against the people of Iraq, and to see all of this as a product of one power which can get away with it, and when the disaster strikes, as it did last week, horribly, maleficently, in the worst and most barbaric way, of course, to see this as a kind of retribution and to see it as a kind of, sort of just deserts and not feel the kind of compassion and fellow suffering that most people would ordinarily feel, partly, they think, because none of that compassion and fellow feeling and fellow suffering has been manifested toward them. They've been treated as the enemy. The United States supports regimes like that of Saudi Arabia, for example, or the Israeli government, because it suits them, not because it's a humane support or support for humane purposes. And in this mind, which we have no inkling of, there's very little interchange on any level at all, really, the connections are made and ascriptions are made for which there's very little contradiction, but simply because the Arab and Islamic world are treated with the kind of contempt and inferiority that we feel they deserve. It's mostly ignorance, I think, a terrible, terrible ignorance, the result of poor education in our part of the world and poor education in their part of the world.
We're talking to Professor Edward Said of Columbia University. Others, as well as Friedman of the New York Times, write of the Taliban in particular and the Muslim world in general as being anti-modern, jealous of American technology, and attacking the United States for its freedom.
Well, this is one of the most monstrous ideological fictions I've ever heard. It was originally started around the time, and gained currency around the time of Huntington's article on the Clash of Civilizations, and it comes from the work of several very, very reactionary, in my opinion, and mischievously inclined, politically inclined Orientalists who have argued exactly that, that the world of Islam is basically a medieval world, that it is a world that resents modernity and, above all, the symbol of modernity, the United States, and so on and so forth. I mean, that's complete nonsense. In the first place, modernity in the sense of McDonald's and, computers and airlines and shopping centers and malls, etc., has come to the entire world, certainly the Islamic world as well. And, you know, it's quite clear that on the level of culture, there is an exchange that goes on despite the ideologues who say that East is East and West is West on both sides. I mean, it's very difficult to distinguish between the everyday life of one over the other. But it is also the case that people in the Islamic world feel that they, for the most part, live in polities, in states, in countries, ruled by unpopular regimes, all of whom, without any exception that I can think of in one way or another, I of course, Iraq is an exception, but are supported by the United States. I mean, one mustn't forget, in the first place, that the Mujahideen, who preceded the Taliban, the previous incarnation of the Taliban, were supported by the United States as fighters on the side of Islam against the godless communists in the Soviet Union in the 1980s. And when their leaders came to Washington in 19... I'll never forget this as long as I live. These bearded people, to my mind, being a secular person from a part of the world that produces monotheistic religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, I was horrified that Reagan greeted these people as, in fact, the moral equivalent of the founding fathers, of our founding fathers. You know, so it suited the United States to coddle these people, as it has all these years the government of Saudi Arabia, because of its oil, not because of its enlightened policies. And many people in these countries, there is a healthy secular opposition. There's a women's movement. There's a human rights movement. So in all respects, I think one can find not only the elements, but the wide currents of modernity inside contemporary Islamic societies. The question is that they're engaged in a political struggle with people who want to take Islam back to some earlier state, just as in this country we have people who want to return. Well, we have Falwell and Robertson and all those hundreds of thousands, millions even, of fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists in this country who want to return us to a puritanical and simpler society. So that's the war. It's not between Islam and the West. It's between ideas of the past that exist in the West and ideas of the past and of the correct tradition that exists in the Islamic world, indeed everywhere in the Jewish world. Look at the struggle within Israel between different interpretations of Judaism. So I would say it's really the struggle of interpretations and not the struggle between modernity, the modernity of the West and the success of America, which most people in the Arab world that I know find very attractive and somewhat at odds with America's behavior internationally as the only superpower on the one hand, and people who want to return society to an earlier, purer, less sinful state. I mean, it exists everywhere.
We're talking to Professor Edward Said, and we'll be back with him in a minute after we break for stations to identify themselves. Then we're going to Peshawar and Islamabad to talk about the humanitarian disaster that is brewing right now in Afghanistan. Up to 1 million Afghans face starvation as Bush officials plan to bomb them. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. And if you're listening online at WBIX.org or later in the day at webactive.com, call your community radio station and encourage them to air the War and Peace Report from Democracy Now! in Exile, Ground Zero Radio. We're also broadcasting on Channel 34 of Manhattan Neighborhood Network, as well as on CUNY Radio that goes out throughout the boroughs of New York, and available on Free Speech TV, Channel 9415 of Dish Network, and any public access station, cable station, can run this program. So encourage your public access station to do that. Just call Free Speech TV in Boulder, Colorado, as we bring together in an unprecedented way community media, from public access to direct satellite to community radio to the internet and the indie media movement around this country. We're talking with Professor Edward Said, a Comparative Literature Institute professor at Columbia University, who has recently written a piece about the latest that has taken place in the United States, the terrorist attacks on Washington and New York, a piece called Collective Passion: Can the Voice of Rationality Be Heard Over the War Drums? This appeared in El Aram Weekly online, based in Cairo. You were just talking about understanding the Muslim and Arab world, and also comparing fundamentalisms, whether it's a Muslim fundamentalism or Christian or Jewish fundamentalism. Would you like to continue on that point?
Yes, I mean, I think the mix of religion with politics, and that I found rather chilling in some of the president's statements, is a very unhealthy one, because, you know, if you think you have the vision and you're in touch with the divine and that speaks through you, then, you know, there's virtually no stopping what you do. I mean, I think that's certainly true of Muslim fundamentalism. It's true of Christians and Jewish fundamentalists, and produces the most skewed and immoral and pathological, I think that's the right word for it, pathological politics. Whereas it would seem to me that as a great country, I mean, with enormous power, it would seem to me that the United States ought to be setting the standard for universalistic norms that apply across religions and across cultures, if you like, that should govern human behavior. There's no reason, for example, why a man who was responsible, like Sharon was, for the massacres of Sabra and Shatila should not be included in the war against terrorism, or why only Muslim terrorists are singled out, as of course in this case they should be. But you know, the idea is that there should be a universal norm, you know, set by the United Nations, obviously, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, by which human behavior, state behavior, is governed, and not these religious justifications with which you can't argue. I mean, if you are possessed of the truth, there's nothing that can be said to you, and that's clearly the mindset of people who believe that God has given them X land and that they should take it and drive out these inferior others who happen to be there, this sort of thing. So I think monotheistic fundamentalism is really the same across the board, and if we want to single out one, we ought really to include in that, not invidiously, but we ought to include inclusively all the others as well.
Professor Saeed, Ariel Sharon, the Israeli Prime Minister, is going to meet with Britain's Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw,
yes,
following a 15-minute phone call between Sharon and the Prime Minister, Tony Blair.
Yes.
Sharon had earlier called off the meeting because of remarks Straw made in an article in an Iranian newspaper. The passage which caused offense said, "One of the factors that helps breed terror is the anger that many people in the region feel at events over the years in the Palestinian territories." Well, Downing Street said the phone call took place this morning at the request of Sharon.
Yes.
Straw is visiting Tehran as part of a U.S.-British effort to form an international coalition that would include Iran. What do you think of this latest, what Straw said, and also the meeting with Sharon?
Well, I think Straw, for the first time, a British official at a high level, that told the truth. I mean, there's no question. There's absolutely no question in the Arab. Don't forget, we live in the age of television and satellite television, which has brought the Arab world together to watch the daily sufferings of Palestinians during the Intifada. I mean, in my opinion, having been there and watching it now from a distance, there's no question that Israel's behavior includes the worst collective punishment that ought to qualify for terrorism, state terrorism, imaginable. I mean, the idea of locking people in their homes, making it impossible for them to travel, demolishing their houses, taking their land, but uprooting, you know, they've uprooted 200,000 trees. I mean, that's sheer sadistic cruelty, to say nothing of endless killings and what they call targeted killings, which are, in fact, assassination of political leaders. I mean, you know, and the settlements go on, and the humiliation of Palestinians at the checkpoints where they can't move without going through Israeli. I mean, this has been a fantastically galvanizing, I would even say polarizing, awareness amongst Arabs everywhere who watch this every day, powerless to do anything about it, and with the United States more or less continually supplying Israel with arms. I mean, that, of course, doesn't in any way justify horrendous acts, heinous acts of criminal violence, senseless, you know, destructiveness of the kind that hit our city. But it goes a long way to explaining a mood in which, you know, the United States and Israel are perceived as malevolent and not the kind of pure and innocent creatures that perhaps they want to pretend they are. So I think what I'm really pleading for is a kind of secular, open, and rational understanding of human behavior, and not to condemn it to the realms of the supernatural and say this is, you know, evil. We don't, you know, it comes from the devil and all. No, no, these are human beings who are acting in unacceptable ways. There are degrees one ought to be able to analyze without, of course, condoning. One ought to be able to explain, and at the same time make judgments. But I think unless one does that, uses one's mind and tries to get past the collective passion, whether it's in the Arab world, in the Islamic world, against the United States, or in our country, against, you know, just wanting to go to war without some understanding of what the ground is like. I don't mean just the geography, but the moral and political and historical ground is like in the minds of others. We live in one world. We don't live in 27 different worlds. And once you know, this campaign is over, we'll have to go back to a world very much altered, in which I think the exchange between peoples becomes, I think, paramount.
And what do you think of bringing Iran into the coalition?
Well, I doubt that Iran will be in the coalition. It's properly speaking, I think the Iranians are, you know, who are the sworn enemies of the Taliban. You know, there's no love lost at all between them. You know, every country acts according to its interests, and Tehran is not, you know, quite in the same position of being pressured as Saudi Arabia and the Emirates are, who have in fact been supporting these Taliban and the Mujahideen originally because the U.S. made them do it. But there are lots of private contributions from these countries to Afghanistan. The Iranians, I think, are in quite a different position, and they may think of this as a way of perhaps improving their position with the United States, but I think entirely on their terms. I don't think there'll be any military action from Iran. I think there will be an attempt to somehow soften the atmosphere and make possible a normal relationship.
The House of Representatives voted yesterday to release $500 million that the United States owes in back dues to the United Nations, ending a long-running squabble at a time when the Bush administration says international cooperation is needed.
Yes.
What do you make of this, right?
Well,
now?
I mean, it's obviously too little, too late. I mean, I'm glad they did it, but we still owe, the United States still owes at least another billion in back dues to the UN. You know, some members of the Senate and House have made no secret of their contempt for the United Nations, and they feel, as I suppose many Americans, but not all, feel that, you know, the United States should go it alone, and why should we be bound by protocols that bind the rest of humanity? Well, you know, maybe this is the beginning of a change, and certainly the efforts on the part of the Bush administration to make this a coalition, to give it some kind of international, perhaps even United Nations legitimacy, is a sign that we're beginning to understand this, that even with our great power and the distance we are from the rest of the world, we're not invulnerable, and we suffer as much as we will and can suffer as much as anyone, and have suffered in the case of this terrible atrocity of September the 11th. But I think there is no hope, in my opinion, for the human community unless we rest our faith, I think, in communal organizations, of which the only universal one is the United Nations, and that we should be bound by the declarations and resolutions, which in many ways we ourselves have formulated. But, I mean, the behavior of the United States in the United Nations has also been scandalous. Promiscuous use of the veto whenever something goes against whenever, for example, Israel is criticized. You know, to use the United Nations, as we did in the case of Iraq, to enter this long period of just slow genocidal torture of the Iraqi people, in which, you know, 500,000 children have died needlessly. Those show in the end, I think, a kind of contempt for the rest of the world that ill suits us as a great power with I think an extremely compassionate population. I think most Americans are given a chance, and I think the media has not been good about this, but given a chance, will try to understand what the U.S. means in the world and what has been done in its name abroad, and that most Americans are open to the sufferings and miseries of others. I must stop.
Finally, Saddam Hussein, where this puts Iraq. You have people like Paul Wolfowitz pushing for the bombing of Iraq. Where do you think Iraq will fit in here? and the vision that you have of what actually is going to happen, since that has not been made very clear at this point, how the U.S. will conduct this so-called war.
Well, I think there's been a, you know, there's been a profound misunderstanding of what Iraq represents in the Arab world. I don't think there's much love lost amongst Arabs for Saddam, for his regime, which is known to be cruel and murderous. And I don't know many people who were in favor of his annexation and invasion of Kuwait in 1990. But you know, it's one thing to be opposed to Saddam and another to want to destroy the country even further. I mean, that seems to me to be sadism. And, you know, there was an opportunity, as no one is tired of remembering or repeating, during the war to enter Baghdad. And if that was the goal, you know, to get rid of him, to get rid of him that way, rather than to starve the Iraqi people. I think there is a struggle going on inside the administration as to what to do about Iraq, who to people, I think, like Wolfowitz, seems to be important only because it might be at one point a threat to Israel. I see that. I mean, Iraq is, by any standard, is not a threat to anyone now. I mean, Saddam obviously is, but the country has been, you know, its infrastructure is destroyed, its people are in terrible shape after years of these sanctions. So I think wanting to destroy Iraq yet again seems to me just gratuitous violence and cruelty for no particular reason. And I doubt that it will occur, but I may be wrong.
Professor Sayed, I want to say thank you very much for being with us, and I hope you are feeling well. Professor Sayed is an Institute Professor of Comparative Literature at Columbia University, author of many books, among them Orientalism and his memoir, Time Out of Place. You are listening to Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. In our second hour, as we continue our two-hour daily specials, we are going to take on the issue of the Bush administration trying to lift all restrictions on arms sales, undoing decades of work by arms control and human rights groups. We also are going to hear about a struggle of a local firehouse in Brooklyn. More than half of the people in that firehouse, the firemen and women, were killed in the World Trade Center bombing, and then the city tried to close the firehouse. But last night, the people won. And we'll go there and also hear from Congressmember Major Owens. But right now, after the break, we turn to Peshawar and Islamabad in Pakistan to find out about the human catastrophe that is unfolding in Afghanistan, with close to a million Afghans facing starvation. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. In our next hour, we're also going to look at the media, and we're joined by Janine Jackson of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who can just give us a glimpse of what you are focusing on now.
Well, the sorts of things you're talking about on this show, Amy, are unfortunately the sorts of things we're not hearing in the mainstream media at large. The first casualty of war is the truth. We remember that. That was from California Senator Hiram Johnson in 1917 at the onset of World War I. The Washington Times updated that quote for their page one headline on September 17th, which read, "Wartime presidential powers supersede liberties. Censorship, martial law, allowed." So we're going to talk about some of the restrictions that are going to be placed on the media. And they're announced. They're saying they're going to do it. They're saying we're going to lie to reporters.
And we're going to talk about that in our second hour. But right now, we go to Peshawar. The United Nations has launched an unprecedented operation to prepare for a massive crisis in Afghanistan as people scramble to escape feared U.S.-led military attacks. UN High Commissioner for Refugees spokesperson Peter Kessler told reporters yesterday that an emergency contingency operation in neighboring Pakistan is the biggest in the agency's history. We turn now to Gordon Weiss of UNICEF in Islamabad. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us what is unfolding? What don't Americans understand about what's happening up to a million Afghans?
Well, what is unfolding is what has been unfolding for the past 3 years. We're at the culminating point, I suppose, of 3 years of severe drought. We have unknown numbers of people moving inside the country. I say unknown because we can't really formulate a clear picture of what's happening since our communications links with national staff inside Afghanistan have been cut, and journalists and aid workers outside Afghanistan can't get inside to form a clear picture. But what we can guess is that people who have already been suffering from drought this summer, a very terrible drought that has depopulated villages, are on the move with the additional problem of fear of military intervention.
There is very little understanding, certainly before what has developed over the last 2 weeks of Afghanistan. Can you talk about why it is that the people face starvation?
Well, there's been no water in Central Asia for the last 3 years, so they can't water crops, and of course that becomes chronic. It means that they're all their fruit trees are basically dying now, shriveling and dying. So there's really long-term damage and long-term famine conditions being created. And of course, you know, Afghanistan has been seen for years as being a bit of a basket case. So UNICEF, for example, had to borrow $5 million using an internal UN instrument just to be able to prepare for this winter in Afghanistan. And we're talking about numbers of recipients, aid recipients of Afghanistan, in Afghanistan, in the region of 5.5 million people.
We're talking to Gordon Weiss. He's speaking to us in Islamabad. We're also going to try right now to go to Peshawar, where Yusuf Hassan is standing by. He is just coming out of a major news conference of hundreds of reporters, UN High Commissioner for Refugees for Afghanistan. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile.
Are you with Jamal Ismail?
Hello, are you with us?
I'm just going to finish a call and I'll be with you. I'm on a call. I just finished.
Yusuf Hassan?
Cut the call, Amy. Hello?
Yusuf Hassan, can you hear us?
I'll be back in a minute. Yes, I can hear you.
Can you tell us what you just spoke about at your news conference?
Well, we are just preparing on the ground for a major influx from Afghanistan. And we are working with the government of Pakistan, non-governmental organization, and other UN agencies to be able to be ready in case there's a major influx into the neighboring countries. And at the moment, we do expect the conditions in Afghanistan to deteriorate because of the long-running conflict as well as the drought. And the thousands and thousands of people who have been on the move out of the cities into the rural areas because of fear of attacks in the past few days.
What needs to be done right now?
Well, we're expecting up to 1.5 million people to flee Afghanistan into the neighboring countries. So what we need is a large amounts of food, tents, blankets, soap, and other material assistance that would be required by people who are famished, exhausted, and hungry, and who are going to come into the neighboring countries with nothing at all.
Yusuf Hassan, I just want to...
We need all the assistance.
Yusuf Hassan, if I just want to ask of Gordon Weiss, if there's a TV there in the background, if you could turn it down, because we're having a hard time hearing.
Yeah, look, I'm standing in a lobby, unfortunately, so there are people around.
If you could cover your hand, if you could put your hand over the speaker then when you're not talking.
How's
so
that?
We can... Thank you very much. Go ahead, Yusuf Hassan.
Well, all kinds of assistance would be required because this would be a massive displacement if it takes place. We already know that huge numbers of people are on the move, and therefore... And the countries that they're coming into, Pakistan and Iran, simply do not have the capacity to cope with such large number of people. This is why there is a very urgent need for the donor community, the international community, to be able to rush to the assistance of these victims of the Afghan situation.
Are people expressing fear of being bombed?
Well, certainly the reason why people are getting away from the cities and into the countryside and into the neighboring countries are obviously a fear that something is going to happen. They have been listening to the radio stations, particularly to the BBC that broadcasts to Afghanistan, and they know that something is going to happen, but nobody knows to what extent and where it may be happening. All they're doing is taking their families and their children to safer places. And there's no other place to look for most of them other than into the neighboring countries.
Right now, UNICEF, as well as United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, you've pulled your aid workers out of Afghanistan. Is that right?
Yes, all the UN agencies have had to withdraw their staff, international staff, from Afghanistan because of the security situation. They have been withdrawn to neighboring Pakistan, where they are in Islamabad.
I want to ask this question to both of you. Yusuf Hassan, who is with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees for Afghanistan, speaking from Peshawar, and Gordon Weiss with UNICEF in Islamabad. There is almost no coverage of this in the United States. What would you say to the U.S. government? Let's start with Gordon Weiss in Islamabad.
Well, it's difficult to send a message to the United States. The United States has actually been a generous donor to Afghanistan, and a large amount of the aid, for example, that was instrumental in enabling us and WHO, the World Health Organization, to begin immunizing up to 5 million children this last weekend, a large proportion of that donation came from the United States. It's not surprising that the grief and terror being felt by Afghanis is being ignored in the wake of the bombings in Washington and New York. But, you know, given time, people will understand that this is not just a military exercise, that the lives of 20 million Afghanis hang in the balance here. And we're just going to have to wait for that to happen. We're just going to have to wait for people to see the unfolding tragedy.
How are you getting food and other aid to people inside Afghanistan?
Well, we have supplies inside Afghanistan which have been pre-positioned, supplies that we pre-positioned prior to the 11th of September. And our national staff inside Afghanistan are still distributing those supplies. The thing is that in common with the World Food Program, those pre-positioned supplies are rapidly dwindling. You know, we work on the basis that we move supplies into the country on a constant basis. Now, the borders are closed. We can't get anything into the country. We can barely get any information out of the country. So what we're doing and what the agencies are planning for at the moment is we're planning for cross-border operations. We're working on the presumption at the moment as one of our contingency plans, that large numbers of people will move towards the borders, and if we can't actually penetrate Afghanistan for whatever reason, let's say there's large-scale military activity going on there, at least we will be able to reach these people. So to that end, UNICEF at least has got 6 flights leaving Denmark this week, loaded with medical equipment, water supply equipment, rehydration salts for children with diarrheal diseases. And we're positioning those in countries like Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Iran, and Pakistan, and moving them up to border positions so that we will be able to reach people more easily from those positions.
And Yusuf Hassan, from your position in Peshawar right now, we understand that the Taliban have confiscated UN supplies in Afghanistan. Is that true?
Well, I am in the Pakistan side of the situation here. I am not in contact, or our organization is not in contact with any of the offices that we have in Afghanistan. Not much information is coming from there. All I can tell you is what is happening on this side, in which there is a lot of anticipation and concern about the plight of many of the people who are trapped in between the major cities where they have left and the border areas, and who are massing up in some of the border areas but are unable to come in because the borders are closed. This is the biggest concern of people here, and that is what everyone here is focusing on in trying to see that we are ready. When it happens, that when they are about to come out, that we ensure that we would lessen their suffering and we'd be able to help them when we can. Those people who are in need of attention and assistance can receive that assistance once they arrive here in Pakistan or in neighboring Iran.
What is the Pakistani government saying why they're not allowing people into Pakistan? Well, they've closed the borders and then sometimes open them.
Well, all indications are that the Pakistani government is, in fact, anticipating an influx. They are working with us in preparing the ground. They have already suggested the sites and the places where these people could be located once they come out. But one could say that they already host one of the largest refugee populations in the world. Pakistan hosts 2 million people. And this is an enormous burden on their economy, on their country, and on their environment. And this is understandable given the fact that there isn't really much assistance coming in to support the Afghan refugees who are already here. That's why we are assuring them that there would be more attention and more assistance coming in for those people who would be allowed. And I think they are convinced that it is necessary at one time or another in the very near future that they would be in a position to open their doors for people who need urgent assistance.
Gordon Weiss in Islamabad, what about the children?
Well, the children, the women and children are the population at most risk at the moment in Afghanistan. We know that 2 weeks ago there were alarming levels of acute malnutrition, of acute respiratory diseases, of acute diarrheal diseases. If you add to that exposure undergone by children and women who are moving from area to area within Afghanistan, looking for food, looking for shelter, and you take into account the fact that there has already been 3 years of drought in the country, you're looking at terribly weak, frightened people, and the first among those are the children. Afghanistan already suffers with a child population with 50% malnutrition. I mean, 50% of all the kids in Afghanistan are malnutritioned in some form. One in every 4 children under the age of 5 dies before they reach 5. There is a young mother, dying every 15 minutes after giving birth to children. I mean, the statistics are just horrendous. So you add to that the sort of borderline stresses of the types of things happening in Afghanistan now, the doubt and the lack of aid, because this is a country that has been living on aid for 20 years. You cut that lifeline all of a sudden, and it only takes a matter of weeks. As it is, we're looking at a 6-week window in which we will be able to ship supplies in to protect the Afghan population before winter sets in. Now let's just stop and imagine what's going to be happening in those next 6 weeks, and you can understand how precarious the situation is for women and children particularly.
How much money is needed right now, not to mention the action that you feel has to be taken? I mean, if the U.S. said they weren't going to bomb Afghanistan, would that alleviate the situation?
Yes, of course it would alleviate the situation. I mean, a lot of the responses taking place inside of Afghanistan are because the authorities there are acting as a country under siege. That's basically why our communications with national staff were cut several days ago. They didn't want us sending any form of information outside the country. That's not difficult to understand. In terms of money, you're already talking about tens of millions of dollars. That's money that we had budgeted just to protect the country this next winter. UN agencies are busy putting together their appeals on the basis of whatever planning we can actually make at the moment. But it's extremely difficult for us to plan. Just as media organizations can't anticipate what's going to happen, exactly the same thing applies to aid agencies. We're working on contingencies. We're working on trying to imagine the number of things that might happen in the next few months.
Well, Gordon Weiss, I want to thank you very much for joining us now in Islamabad, Pakistan, representing UNICEF. Yusuf Hassan on the phone with us from Peshawar, Pakistan, with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. He is the area coordinator from Afghanistan. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to write to us, send us email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. We have many people to thank for this unprecedented collaboration between television, radio, and the internet community broadcasters. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland at the helm at WBIX.org. You can also hear us at webactive.com. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Karen Renucci, Dee Dee Halleck, Tom Poole, Lenny Charles, and our hosts here at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Suno. Also to Lizzie Ratner, Sam Delgado, and Orlando Richards, our camera people. And thank you to Pacifica stations, especially KPFA and Pacific affiliate KFCF in Fresno, all our affiliates around the country. We are Pacifica, broadcasting from the historic firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown, in the evacuation zone in exile, from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the band, and the fired from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Stay with us for our second hour.
I just went on told her. She asked me why. I just went on told her.
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! In Exile. President Bush pressures Congress for authority to waive all existing restrictions on U.S. military assistance and weapons exports to U.S. allies for the next 5 years, including human rights abusing nations. In a victory for the people of Park Slope, a thwarting of the Giuliani administration's attempts to close their firehouse after 12 of their firefighters were killed in the World Trade Center attack. Will civil liberties and privacy be sacrificed by the Bush administration's new anti-terrorism laws? And we'll look at Bush's hastily prepared package, which could greatly expand police powers. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from Ground Zero. The United Nations has launched an unprecedented operation to prepare for a massive crisis in Afghanistan as people scramble to escape the feared U.S.-led military strikes. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees told AFP an emergency contingency operation in neighboring Pakistan is the biggest in the agency's history. Crisis management specialists and equipment to deal with hundreds of thousands of refugees were continuing to pour into Pakistan on Afghanistan's eastern border amid reports that more than a million people could try to flee in the event of U.S. strikes. And a group of Norwegian academics say that President George Bush should be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize if he manages to avoid a war. The 12 university professors and other intellectuals nominated Bush in a Norwegian daily newspaper. They said their pacifist proposal was aimed to make the world think about ways of solving conflict without escalating violence. President Bush launched a financial offensive against Osama bin Laden yesterday, freezing the assets of the Saudi exiles organization and its sympathizers while threatening foreign banks with the same treatment if they failed to cooperate with the U.S. initiative. The order froze the assets of 27 individuals and organizations suspected of links with bin Laden's al-Qaeda and other networks. It went further than a similar order issued by the Clinton administration, expanding the category of targeted groups to include all those, quote, associated with designated terrorist groups. The order also gave the Treasury Department the authority to freeze the U.S. assets and transactions of foreign banks which do not cooperate with the U.S. President Bush yesterday backed off the administration's pledge to quickly release evidence against Osama bin Laden. He said doing so could, quote, make the war more difficult to win. Secretary of State General Colin Powell, standing at Bush's side, sent an entirely different signal a day earlier when he said the administration in the near future will be able to release a document that, quote, will describe quite clearly the evidence. The ruling Taliban in Afghanistan has said it would hand over Osama bin Laden if the U.S. presented credible evidence of his guilt. Other countries have also urged the U.S. to use legal mechanisms in its quest for justice rather than military force. The Airline Pilots Association will ask Congress to allow pilots to carry guns in the cockpits of commercial airlines. John Mazur said the organization, which represents pilots at Delta Airlines, will testify that some pilots want to be trained as armed federal officers. This would be strictly on a voluntary basis, Mazur said. Pilots would be trained and sworn in. Mazur said he sees arming pilots as a last resort for pilot safety and should be included among other options such as modifying cockpit doors. The Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is to meet the Foreign Secretary of Britain, Jack Straw, following a 15-minute phone call between Sharon and the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. Sharon had earlier called off the meeting because of remarks Straw made in an article for an Iranian newspaper. The passage, which caused offense, said one of the factors that helps breed terror is the anger that many people in the region feel at events over the years in the Palestinian territories. That was a quote of Britain's Foreign Secretary Jack Straw. Downing Street said the phone call took place this morning at the request of Sharon. Straw is today visiting Tehran as part of the U.S.-British effort to form an international coalition in the wake of the deadly attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. The Israeli Foreign Ministry told British officials yesterday that it was Straw's statement that could be interpreted as ascribing blame to Israel and his understanding for terrorist attacks against Israeli citizens. Key legislators in Albany and New York City yesterday flatly rejected extending Mayor Giuliani's term, even as members of the mayor's inner circle split over whether he should try to remain in office past December 31st. The primary is today in New York for mayor of New York.
And I'm going to continue to say it to America. Because I love this country too much to see the drift that it has taken. God didn't call America to do what she's doing in the world now. God didn't call America to engage in a senseless, unjust war as the war in Vietnam. And we are criminals in that war. We've committed more war crimes almost than any nation in the world. And I'm going to continue to say it.
Sad and lonely all the time. That's because I've got a worried mind. You know the world is in an uproar. The danger zone is everywhere. Everywhere. Just read your paper and you see just exactly what keeps worrying me. Yeah, you see the world is in an uproar. The danger zone is everywhere. My love for the world is like always. For the world is a part of me.
Ray Charles, Danger Zone, following the Reverend Martin, Dr. Martin Luther King. Here on Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report, we encourage you to call your community radio stations to air this daily two-hour special. As we broadcast from the evacuation zone, we are at the historic Firehouse Engine 31, just blocks from where the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration's urgent quest for new anti-terrorism laws bogged down in Congress yesterday as lawmakers from both parties expressed concern that the hastily prepared package could greatly expand police powers at the expense of privacy and other civil liberties. At a hearing of the House Judiciary Committee, skeptical members confronted Attorney General John Ashcroft and other senior Justice Department officials on a number of administration proposals, including one that would permit the indefinite detention without trial of immigrants suspected of ties to terrorist organizations. They also said the administration is trying to force the package through Congress without giving lawmakers time to adequately digest proposals that could have serious unforeseen consequences for rights that Americans now take for granted. The Washington Post quotes Congress member Robert Barr, the well-known right-wing representative from Georgia, who asked, why is it necessary to rush this through? Does it have anything to do with the fact that the department has sought many of these authorities on numerous other occasions, has been unsuccessful in obtaining them, and now seeks to take advantage of what is obviously an emergency situation to obtain authorities that it has been unable to obtain previously? We go first to Nadine Strossen on the phone with us. She is president of the American Civil Liberties Union. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report.
I'm so happy to be there, Amy.
Well, can you tell us about what Ashcroft has proposed as we hear more ambulances race down the streets outside us in Chinatown?
There are several major areas of concern for the ACLU and all of us who prize our civil liberties, Amy. One is the area of immigration, as you mentioned in your excellent introduction. Another is the area of surveillance, in particular electronic surveillance of phone communications and online communications, emails, and internet access. And then we also have a lot of concerns in the area of criminal justice. Now, let me say at the outset that one of the overriding concerns is that all of these laws are drafted so broadly that we fear that their major impact, if not their only impact, is going to have nothing to do with the very important task of seeking justice for those who are engaged in terrorism or will be engaged in terrorism, but in fact is going to be used for bread and butter law enforcement activities. And there I completely agree with Bob Barr's sentiment that this is the kind of power that has always been sought by those who are seeking to prosecute not the war against terrorism, but the war on drugs. And what might not be so well known about Congressman Bob Barr is his extensive law enforcement background. He was a U.S. attorney. He was a state attorney general. He can hardly be accused of being soft on crime. And yet, as an experienced prosecutor, he has agreed with civil libertarians that the measures that are being asked for are not necessary effectively to enforce either the drug laws or the laws of very extensive laws against terrorism that already exist.
You know, I was thinking as I read this piece in the Washington Post that it says the administration's bill would make it easier for law enforcement agencies to eavesdrop on suspected terrorists by expanding wiretap authority from single phone lines to multiple modes of communication linked to a suspect, such as cell phones and email. Now, if you take away to a suspect and eavesdrop on suspected terrorists, in the case that this happens, of course, this could be anyone. It gives you the right to do it, the government to do it to anyone. What we're talking about is simply making it easier for law enforcement to eavesdrop, to expand wiretaps, and to go from single phones to multiple modes of communication, including cell phones and email.
Right. And the whole by inherent concept, wiretapping already ensnares many, many completely innocent conversations and communications. That's why when it was initially introduced, a number of Supreme Court justices thought it was inherently unconstitutional because it's not a targeted search. I'm not going to argue that, but I am going to point out that we already have record-breaking numbers of wiretaps in this country. We already have the unprecedented surveillance technology of Echelon, which has been of concern to the European community, and has that they've written an official report documenting the millions of completely innocent conversations by citizens and citizens groups that are being surveyed by our government working in concert with other governments around the world. We already have the carnivore technology, which means that anytime the FBI is looking for email communications from the target of an investigation, all communications going in and out of passing through the same internet service provider that is accessed by that target, all of those communications are also available to the government. So, in fact, I've heard FBI officials complain in the media and before Congress that they don't have enough personnel to analyze the fruits of the surveillance that already exists. So it's not really going to aid the anti-terrorism effort. In fact, the ACLU did a report after the 1996 anti-terrorism law, and let us not forget that already expansive government investigative powers were expanded quite dramatically in 1996, and I'm happy to say again that this law and order conservative Bob Barr worked very closely with ACLU back then to oppose it, but it passed. He thought that one went too far, and we did a report, an excellent report called Big Brother in the Wires, taking the government's own numbers about the amount of wiretapping that was going on under that new legislation. We showed that the vast majority of them had nothing to do with suspected terrorist activity or crimes, violent crimes that might be engaged in by terrorists, but in fact had to do with the drug crimes and gambling crimes. And that's not surprising. The so-called victimless crimes are the ones where the government really has traditionally depended on electronic surveillance.
We're also joined in our Firehouse studio by Janine Jackson, and she's with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Media Watch Group. Janine, you've been particularly looking at the civil liberties issue and how the media is dealing with it.
Yes, while Nadine is talking about powers that the administration is trying to grab at the moment to gather information, they're also trying to gain power, the very connected power, to withhold information. A military official, unnamed, of course, gave this really chilling quote to the Washington Post just yesterday. This is the most information-intensive war you can imagine. We're going to lie about things. He said that directly. And we're already seeing the withholding of information. They're already talking about further restrictions in advance of the Gulf War protocols that had been set up, in which journalists were herded into pools, military officers told them who they could photograph, who they could not, who they could interview, and so forth. We have the Bush administration now saying they want to junk those rules and go for something even more severe, where perhaps journalists will not even be allowed anywhere near the action. So I think it's something to be very, very concerned about. Reporters understand that they aren't going to be reporting on troop movements or something like this, but if we don't learn what is being done and why things are being done, there will be simply no way for the public to make informed choices about policy in the future. We won't know if all these measures that are being taken now have any effect, have negative effect, you know, achieve the goals they're set out for, if reporters are not allowed to even get the basic information to talk about them.
Janine, have you ever seen the media in such lockstep as we are now?
Well, the truth is, I don't think it is exactly lockstep right now. I think some of the highest profile people, the Dan Rathers and the Bill O'Reilly, seem to be in a contest to see who is more uncritical and patriotic. However, I am seeing things around the edges, these concerns, these questions. I mean, this is Howard Kurtz in the Washington Post quoting this military officer saying he's going to mislead the public. And I think expressing some concerns about that.
I am seeing some things in the newspapers, but what really manufactures consent is television. That's what beats the drum for war. And you've got the logo of, you know, CNN, America's new war. And so you don't have people on talking about not going to war, but just how fast we do it, et cetera.
And that exactly. And you have, you know, stations fighting battles because reporters, some are saying they don't want to have to wear an American flag on their lapel while they're on television. They don't think that's appropriate. You know, they're still planning to do the best job of journalism they can. They think that is simply inappropriate. And there are these,
who is asking them
tests
to do that?
Well, there have been, we've heard sort of internal battles. There's a Baltimore TV station I talked about last time where reporters had to, you know, promise fealty on air. Other places have been doing it voluntarily, and there's been, we've heard, sort of internal pressure. Oh, you're not wearing one? I'm not, you know, we don't need this at the moment. This is not what the public needs to be focusing on.
On the issue of crackdown on civil liberties, Nadine Strossen of the ACLU, the other issue at the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, Ashcroft's proposed expansion of a provision of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which governs wiretapping of non-Americans inside the United States, ran into trouble not only with Democrats, but also with at least one Republican member. That was Senator Mike DeWine of Ohio. Patrick Leahy and members of his staff worked with administration officials last weekend as they raced to complete their anti-terrorism bill. But what about specifically immigrants when it comes to civil liberties?
Well, you do not forfeit all rights by living in this country without being a citizen. Conversely, we have always guaranteed very fundamental rights to all people in this country, whether they are Americans or not. That's very clear when you look at the constitutional language of the Due Process Clause, which is the most important one because that makes the whole Bill of Rights enforceable at every level of government. And as Justice Stephen Breyer said in a decision just last summer, it deliberately refers, that language deliberately refers to all persons in the United States, in contrast to a couple other constitutional provisions that refer explicitly only to citizens. So you should not have to forfeit your rights just by virtue of not having been born here or become a citizen. And what's very frightening is, again, going back to my theme of the government already has such expansive power, particularly in the wake of the 1996 anti-terrorism law. Why does it need any more? Under the 1996 anti-terrorism terrorism law, the government has the power to detain potentially indefinitely all non-citizens based on secret evidence. This, to me, is an absolutely Kafkaesque situation in a supposedly the leader of the free world, and I do believe that our country should live up to that ideal, and in many ways does, but falls far short when it came to the secret evidence, to the extent that even when he was campaigning for president, George W. Bush supported a repeal of the secret evidence law, and Congress had was strongly considering legislation that would have repealed the ability to detain non-Americans on secret evidence. Instead, the legislation that is now being considered goes in the opposite direction. It requires almost no evidence at all, from secret evidence to no evidence. The Attorney General basically can certify in his discretion, without citing any evidence, that he believes that this non-American may endanger national security. And once he's issued that certification, then the person can be detained potentially indefinitely.
Nadine Strossen, president of the ACLU. And finally, Janine Jackson, front page Washington Post today. More than 350 people have been swept up in the massive dragnet for witnesses and suspects cast since the September 11th terrorist attacks in New York and Washington.
I'm happy to hear the Washington Post reporting that figure. I'm afraid we're not going to be able to get as much and as specific information on just who is being detained, because Attorney General Ashcroft basically threatened to the Washington Post, or reported in the Washington Post, that they may stop disclosing arrests of material witnesses. And in fact, the Justice Department said they may stop releasing figures on people who have been detained on immigration charges. All of this in an attempt to sort of shroud the actions from public scrutiny. It's a very frightening time.
I want to thank you both for joining us. Janine Jackson with FAIR. You can go to the website at FAIR.org. Again, none of the detainees has been charged with a crime directly related to the attacks. Nadine Strossen with the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, will certainly continue to follow these issues. When we come back from our break, we're going to take a look at the Bush administration lifting restrictions on giving military aid to human rights abusing countries. And then we're going to go to a local struggle with more than half of the firefighters killed at a local firehouse in Brooklyn. The city has tried to close that firehouse, but yesterday the people won their battle to keep it open. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Channel 34 today, on CUNY around New York City, on public access stations around the country, on Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. That's FSTV Channel 9415. And we're broadcasting on Pacifica stations and affiliates around the country. WBIX.org as well. Stay with us. You're listening to Ground Zero Radio's Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report as we break the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. every time we turn around, it seems that another regulation is being lifted that protects civil liberties or other cases. We've just heard that dealing with terrorism, President Bush says they will try to push through fast-track legislation. And also, there's this. Over the weekend, President Bush asked Congress for authority to waive all existing restrictions on U.S. military assistance and weapons exports for the next 5 years. Separately, on Saturday, Bush lifted all military and economic restrictions on India. He also removed restrictions that barred Pakistan from economic assistance and prevented it from making commercial military purchases from U.S. companies. The new proposal would allow the president to lift human rights restrictions imposed by Congress on U.S. military cooperation with other countries, effectively undoing decades of work by human rights and arms control groups. We first go to Tubar Gabelnik, who is with the Federation of American Scientists. Tamar, can you tell us what the proposal of the Bush administration is?
Well, there are conflicting stories and rumors, as there have been many in Washington over the past couple weeks. The original story was that the president, or actually the State Department, put forward language to Congress last week saying that the president would basically have a blank check to approve military aid and arms transfers to states and non-state actors, in as long as doing so would support not just efforts to prevent or respond to acts of terrorism, but also other actions threatening international peace and security. And I'm reading from a draft bill that I have in front of me. And that would be for 5 years, from fiscal years 2002 to 2007. And basically, it would get rid of, would apply to all restrictions in the Arms Export Control Act and Foreign Assistance Act, but then he also singles out, especially for anti-terrorism aid, that would especially apply to limits that are now in place on countries that have gross and consistent human rights violations, or also to countries that do not cooperate on terrorism. So basically he's saying, and then the bill was saying, in the name of fighting terrorism, we can now support countries that have not been helpful on terrorism. So that was bill number one. Now, yesterday there was a bit of a snafu because President Bush apparently denied that this bill existed, or the draft bill existed. And so that left the State Department apparently scrambling, and they put forward different language because if the president said there was no such language, then there was no such language. So now it's just applying to Pakistan and India. That's of today. I don't know what tomorrow will bring.
We're also joined on the telephone by Kurt Biddle, Washington coordinator of the Indonesia Human Rights Network. The restrictions that are being lifted would apply directly to Indonesia. This past week, the Indonesian president, Megawati Sukarno-Putri, came to Washington. What happened on that visit?
Well, the visit, there was a lot of vague promises made by President Gawabi saying that she understood the value of human rights accountability and respecting human rights. And Bush kind of showered her with a lot of promises, some of them of substance, some of them he needs to check in with Congress to make sure he can get it, including money for police training. He also said that he was lifting the White House termed as a ban on commercial military sales, non-lethal items. That actually was never a ban, except during the Clinton administration right after the East Timor referendum and the military ravaged East Timor with their sponsored militias. So this actually has been in place. So some of it was a little bit of fluff, but there was some concrete things that he's going to try to hit up Congress with, and that includes police training. And I think there's a general move from the White House to try to get rid of all these restrictions that are based there for human rights.
You know, it's interesting. I was just talking to somebody in Indonesia, and as we were speaking, he was watching television. And one of the commentators came on and said, this gives us the right to, they will train us in low-intensity warfare, taking it as a green light. for U.S., you know, working with the Indonesian military, something, as you point out, has been fought for the last 2 years.
Yeah, I think that this has been seen as a victory for the Megawati regime. Her regime was a bit shaky. Her own vice president opposed her back when Wahid was voted president, and because she was a woman, and said that Islam doesn't allow women to be leaders. So she had a rough coalition of groups, very shaky. But now she comes back with some promises from the U.S., and she's looked at as, you know, a winner now. And the Indonesian military, who have held hands with Megawati for quite a while now, also see this as a victory.
We're going to move on to John Rusa, who's just returned from Indonesia. But Kurt Biddle, what do you think in the human rights group you're with, the Indonesia Human Rights Network, people can do? And since you're not on a great line on a cell phone, if you can just give out the contact information.
Yeah. People need to contact their representatives and senators and tell them that this congressional ban limiting military assistance to Indonesia that's been set up since 1999 is actually good legislation, should just not be thrown out the door. So they should call the congressional switchboard. That's 202-224-3121. To find out the direct numbers, talk to the foreign policy staffer and tell them that we shouldn't be rewarding military or police forces that are out of control with training or equipment, and that they should continue to keep these restrictions in place. The Senate is expected to be voting on these in the next couple of weeks, the so-called Leahy conditions. People can contact the Indonesia Human Rights Network at area code 202-393-5533, or look for us on the web at www.indonesianetwork.org.
Thanks very much, Kurt Biddle, with the Indonesia Human Rights Network. John Rusa is also on the line with us, who is a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute for International Studies at UC Berkeley. John, you've recently come from Indonesia. What is the situation on the ground? And also, what will this mean for Aceh, which is an extremely troubled region of Indonesia, where more than a million more than a thousand Muslims have been killed since the beginning of the year?
Well, I think it's going to mean a disaster for Aceh. There's a good possibility that Indonesia will advertise the struggle in Aceh against the Indonesian military as a terrorist movement, and thereby criminalize them within the international arena. There have already been hints of that, attempts to do that, even though the Achenese struggle has not been, has not really taken the form at all of a movement that would kill civilians or commits bombings. So that would be one effect. And the other effect would be it gives the green light to the Indonesian military to continue to commit human rights abuses within Aceh, without any fear of any international tribunal or any restrictions from the U.S. government on military aid. There has been no accounting for their last major war crimes in East Timor in 1999. So naturally, they will commit, they will continue to commit atrocities in Aceh.
John Rusa, some conservative Muslim groups in Indonesia have warned of a jihad if the U.S. attacks Afghanistan. What does the Megawati administration seem to be saying on this? Where do these groups fit into the political spectrum? The other day, there were two bombs that went off in Jakarta. It's not clear who was responsible for them. Yeah. They said they would go through hotels and pick out Americans.
Yeah, well, the Megawati government is in a bit of a bind right now because they have her government, as has the previous government, as have the police and the military, been reluctant to do anything to curb the activities of these Muslim groups. I'm thinking primarily of Lashkar Jihad, which is based in Jogjakarta, and whose leader went to Afghanistan, was there in 1988, 1989, and received military training there. And he is known as the commander of the forces, and they have done quite a bit of damage, especially in eastern India, Indonesia, to ruin the ethnic relations there and relations between religions, and is now trying to do it in Sulawesi, another island. So also an organization called FPI, or Islamic Defense Front, which is primarily in Jakarta, they're the ones that are largely calling for this jihad. And they have acted often with official connivance and even with support of some elements within the military. So it is going to be very difficult for the government to crack down on these organizations. However, the Megawati government has received what could be considered as an ultimatum from the U.S. government that it has to crack down on these organizations so that the personnel of the U.S. multinational companies within Indonesia would feel safe. I read there are something like 6,000 Americans working in Indonesia, and this does represent quite a serious threat to their safety. And if they leave, some major facilities that provide foreign exchange for the Indonesian government would close down, such as the Freeport Mine in Irian Jaya, which perhaps would be attacked, and the Freeport office within Jakarta.
Freeport McMoRan being running one of the largest gold and copper mining operations in the world in Irian Jaya, West Papua, a part of Indonesia right now.
So I think Megawati's government is going to do something to protect U.S. personnel and U.S. investment. I think inevitably they cannot do without that foreign exchange, without that revenue. But I think the best way to deal with such Muslim groups is to improve the economy and to provide social welfare. And that is something that the government does not want to do. And instead, the government is paying back the debt of the Suharto regime. And much of the government's budget, and depending on how you count it and depending on who's counting, it can be as much as the over 50% of the national budget is being sent to the U.S., Japan, and Europe to pay back the foreign debt. And if the U.S. actually wants to help Indonesia, it would cancel a good part of that debt, which was, of course, due to corruption. Much of it was due to corruption.
Finally, Tabar Gabelnik, mm-hmm. What are arms control groups doing to mobilize against the lifting of restrictions on human rights abusing nations?
Well, we are having an emergency meeting today to talk about options, but basically we're just going to be writing into the International Relations and Foreign Relations Committees to protest these changes. I think we'll have a fairly empathetic ear on the Hill because they're not happy about it just for purely turf battle reasons, that this is denying them the power to have the control over arms exports. So I'm sure we'll get a lot of sympathy there. I don't know how hard we're going to need to press. But basically, we need to pay close attention to this because it seems like, though the administration is going back and forth on the latest proposal, that they could try to sneak something in, and in the name of national unity and bipartisanship, Congress might be forced to sign on to something that they wouldn't otherwise do. So we're going to be, again, if people were interested in speaking out, they should write to their member of Congress and say that they oppose the giving a blank check to the administration to sell arms to whomever it pleases, and also write the same thing to the State Department, because it was the State Department that put forward this proposal in the beginning, which is upsetting, because they've usually been a force for more progressive foreign policy when it comes to arms exports.
Maybe it has something to do with the Secretary of State being a former general. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Tamar Gabelnik with the Federation of American Scientists, and Kurt Biddle, who we just heard from before with the Indonesian Human Rights Network, and John Rusa, who is a postdoc fellow at the Institute for International Studies at University of California, Berkeley. Tomorrow, Thich Nhat Hanh and Judy Collins. But we're going to break, and when we come back, we'll hear the story of a firehouse in Brooklyn and development that's already being talked about in the wake of the attacks on the World Trade Center. Stay with us.
When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are
You are listening to Ground Zero Radio's War and Peace Report, Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Even before the last of the fires at the World Trade Center have been extinguished, developers and city, state, federal officials are jockeying for control of the rebirth of Lower Manhattan. At a meeting last week with 30 of the city's largest developers and brokers, local officials insisted the city must direct redevelopment efforts. The city's powerful real estate developers, meanwhile, are promoting their own plans for downtown, demanding tax breaks to subsidize the construction of new office towers and incentives to lure tenants back to a section of the city which has been devastated by the September 11th attack. On a smaller scale, the city of New York informed a Brooklyn firehouse that it would be closed. Squad 1 lost 12 of its firefighters as they fought to save people's lives at the World Trade Center. The city said that all of the remaining firefighters would be reassigned to other fire department houses. The city has tried to close the firehouse before, and community members speculated that the Giuliani administration may have been trying to cash in on the tragedy. The firehouse sits on prime real estate in the rapidly gentrifying neighborhood. But in a victory for the people, the Park Slope community rapidly mobilized, hammering city officials with phone calls, flocking in the hundreds to a protest outside the firehouse last night. New York City announced yesterday that it never intended to close the station. Well, we go now to last night's protest-turned-celebration, where Democracy Now! In Exile producer Chris Abrams was there.
My name is Ronald Fitzpatrick. I'm a retired fireman from this firehouse, from this unit. I was injured in the line of duty and forced to retire a bunch of years ago. I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico now, raising a family. And I just had to come back. This is family. This is brothers. When I saw the names on a list that were missing, this is where I had to be. We live and die together. And you don't separate us, and you don't take and hurt one of my people, or we don't have people that are lost and not found yet and take us away and separate us. It's not acceptable. This city is in turmoil. This city has been hurt. There's 6,000 to 7,000 people missing, and you don't do things to create more havoc. You make it work. Why did guys get hurt? Why did guys get lost? Why are guys dead? Because we go into the buildings. We don't stay outside. It's not a social event, and we don't talk about it. We do something. And that's why we have that many people missing.
Hi, my name is Mitchell Cohn. I'm from the Brooklyn Greens. I'm one of the Green Party candidates for mayor. I'm running a write-in campaign in Tuesday's election. We heard also that one of the reasons why they were trying to close the firehouse was the real estate. You know, this is a very, you could talk to some of the people around off the record. They'll tell you that the brass was sort of talking about that off the record, that this is a very expensive real estate property. Instead of saying, okay, we'll channel more fire personnel into this area and we'll put a new truck here, they're saying, let's close it down. So our role is to fight to keep fire houses open all over the city, not only this one, and also to expand it. A few years ago, Giuliani shut down a whole bunch of firehouses, and we need to open them up again, too. I mean, this is defending the community. It's nonsense. And so the Green Party, like all the other parties around, strongly supports what the fire department is doing. I mean, they don't go around beating people up. They don't go around racial profiling. They go putting out fires and saving people regardless of their political beliefs or what they look like or anything. And we have to defend that. This is central to the community, and we're not going to let them shut it down for privatization or any other reasons. And those bastards who try are going to have to meet with the wrath of the community, organized, as they could see now. Well, there were about, say, around 700 or 800 people out here today, at least. And that's quite a good turnout for 7-hour notice.
My name is Gloria Matera. I live in Park Slope. I'm running for City Council in District 39 on the Green Party line. And, you know, I'm here in support of this firehouse. I'm just very concerned that after a terrible tragedy that they have had to face and still wondering about their men and wondering about what's going to happen in this city, that they would even get a rumor or even a possibility of being closed down. And I'm also very concerned that with all the billions of dollars they're talking about in bailing out corporations, the airlines, what about city services? What about all the things we have been talking about before the World Trade Center? No affordable housing, 1.8 million people with no health insurance, privatizing city services. That's been going on for a long time, and now it will be the fight for the corporations, for the dollars that are going to come into New York City, and we need to elect people that are going to think about the majority of citizens, including the uniformed officers who are working class people, and will have a harder time. There's rumors that some politicians are supporting the idea of investing union pension funds into the stock market to help boost the stock market while the city government bails out corporations and gives tax breaks for corporations to move back into some towers they think they're going to build. But I hope that that's not going to happen, and they're going to put something significant to memorialize the people who died in the World Trade Center on that site.
Hello, I'm Congressman Major Owens, and I want to associate myself with all the great remarks that have been made already, and I won't repeat them. I'll just say what a difference a day makes. At midnight last night, I was told they were going to close this firehouse tomorrow. I couldn't believe it. I was over here at 7:30 this morning to see for myself, to hear for myself. I went back to my office. We started a barrage of calls to City Hall and letters, etc. And about 3 o'clock, I got a call from City Hall saying it was a great mistake. I think the decision was made that we don't tangle with the folks in Park Slope.
Can I ask your reaction to Washington's response to what's happened on September 11th?
Well, Washington's response is embarrassment, because we are the leaders who are supposed to protect our citizens and make them secure. And in a very big way, it was demonstrated that we have not done that. So Washington, unfortunately, is bordering on hysteria now. You know, there are things that have to be done, but I think that the great danger is that there'll be an overreaction, we'd like to see to it that we keep our eyes on the prize. There are fanatics, there are madmen in the world, and we need to concentrate on ways to root them out, ways to make the environment that they survive in uncomfortable, ways to cut off the organized terrorism that it appears to have roots that spread all over the world. We can deal with that, and we should deal with that, with a more competent set of intelligence agencies, a more competent law enforcement agencies. In many ways, the CIA and the FBI have demonstrated that they lack that competence, and for a long time, many of us have complained about the fact that they were so incompetent. And partially, part of what has happened here did not need to happen. I don't think they could have been so successful had we had a more competent set of law enforcement and intelligence agencies. And that's the first thing we have to do. The military invasions and the larger actions tend to be for show only. They may get us into situations where we are demonstrating the anger of the nation and the resolve of the nation in ways that will only complicate matters. And there are many of us who are trying to make certain that we keep our eyes on the prize. The first thing to do is to really come to grips with the fact that we spend $30 billion on our CIA, and it does not do the job it's supposed to do, and partially because of the fact that it's not racially integrated, it's not diverse enough. The problems of its own biases have come home to hurt the effort to keep in touch with the people of the world. And a lot of practical things have to be done, but we must stay on guard against hysteria that might really do a great deal of harm.
There seems to be quite a bipartisan consensus on what to do since September 11th. Democrats seem to be voting with Republicans on almost everything. What is your response to that?
Democrats have reported vote Republicans because a lot of it's symbolism. You know, the War Powers Act gives the president all the powers that he needs to deal with the situation. The resolution we passed in Congress was a way to say to the public that we're all on the same playing field. We all reaffirm the fact that the president does have the power. He had the power already. He has the power. A lot of it's symbolism, and a lot of it is mixed in a way where we can't avoid it. The airlines bailout bill that I voted for last week, I was not happy about the fact that it didn't take care of airline workers that were being laid off. And I almost voted against it. But on the other hand, it's established a victims fund, unprecedented. The federal government has taken responsibility for every victim of that catastrophe, you know, from the guys who are CEOs down to the level of the cafeteria workers. They don't have to fight the insurance companies. Their families don't have to fight the insurance companies. It's going to be a fund. And I could not vote against that. That was unprecedented. And we had to take consideration that we have all these tremendous losses of life.
Finally, the anti-terrorism legislation could make it possible to detain immigrants indefinitely with no public evidence.
Well, that's the most frightening part of the legislation, because we've seen Quantelpro, and we know how an already incompetent FBI and already incompetent CIA are likely to abuse those powers in order to score hits in terms of public relations, in order to have somebody to punish. They'll go off cock and punish innocent people. And even large numbers and groups of people will be profiled in ways that have been done in the past. And they've spent a lot of time chasing people who were totally innocent, had nothing to do with anything, but it was good public relations for them. So that's a great danger. We are very concerned about the anti-terrorism provisions as they affect the domestic situation.
New York Congress member Major Owen speaking to Democracy Now! In Exile producer Chris Abrams at the Park Slope Firehouse. The people won a victory yesterday. Squad 1 lost 12 of its firefighters as they fought to save people's lives at the World Trade Center. And then the city moved in to close that firehouse, which sits on prime real estate in the rapidly gentrifying neighborhood of Park Slope.
When you're down and out.
You're listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Among other things on this program, we are documenting the peace movement in all of its expressions. At 12 noon on Saturday, September 22nd, over 100 artists, all wearing black, filed onto Union Square in Manhattan, where many people have been gathering for the last 10 days to grieve and to try to make sense of what happened on September 11th. When the people filed into Union Square, a hush fell over the crowd as the artists took their places in a semicircle. For 1 hour, they stood in silence, wearing face masks and placards silkscreened with, "Our grief is not a cry for war." D'Lo now joins us. She is with the group Refuse and Resist, an artist in New York. Tell us about that moment when you all stood there.
It was really incredible. Like you said, you know, a hush fell over the crowd. But what was really important was that people were coming. We had one person going through the crowd to sort of answer questions and to get people's addresses and emails or whatever. And people were just thoroughly moved, and the people were crying coming up to our spokesperson and just saying how dope it was that artists or these people were actually taking a stand this way and doing it in a very impactful manner. It being a silent protest really made a difference than anything else that was going on that day at that time. And, you know, it would just to be a part of it and to be a part of something that was put up by other artists was just incredible.
Who came up with the slogan, "Our grief is not a cry for war"?
One individual in particular who is part of the artist network of Refuse and Resist, he came up with the slogan, and we sort of like made it our statement. A brother named Dred Scott.
Tell us what happened afterwards. You all had stickers that you gave out.
Yeah, we took up this this slogan as our sort of nugget to put out there, and basically we put it out over a website, and lots of people nationally have taken it and made their own copies about the sticker on the sticker, and we've just been, you know, handing them out, you know, putting them up places, and just really trying to get that, you know, that statement out there to change the climate of what's already out there, you know, as how the government's basically using our grief and the grief of those who have lost family members in the bombing as an excuse for war, you know. So this was sort of like our way to like change up that climate.
Can you D'Lo, artist with Refuse and Resist. Again, that slogan, that sentence that's being repeated and seen in placards all over the city. Our grief is not a cry for war. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to email us, send your mail to mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer, Errol Maitland at WBIX.org, where you can hear Democracy Now! Online, as well as webactive.com. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, who I know, Karen Renucci, Didi Halleck, Tom Poole, Lenny Charles, Lizzie Ratner, Sam Delgado, Orlando Richards, our hosts here at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno. Thank you to the Pacifica stations, especially KPFA and KFCF in Fresno, and of course to all our affiliate stations around the country. We are Pacifica. You can see the program in New York on channels 34 and 56 on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, on Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of Dish TV Satellite Network. We're in the historic firehouse of Engine 31, Chinatown, and the evacuation zone just next to Ground Zero. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman.